The Senate Public Safety Budget Division will come to order. Today is Monday, March 5th, 2007.
Wishful thinking, Mr. Chair.
Almost did that. And do we have Senator Scheid? We're waiting for you, Senator Scheid. Oh.
Chairman, I'm sitting around here. I couldn't hear you.
Senate File 1177.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to have people who are going to testify come on up.
Welcome to the committee hearing. I see Sheriff and the Chief of Police and our Senator. Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm sitting in a good place. I feel good. I just wanted to say a couple things. I actually would like to ask if I realize you can't probably vote just yet, but like to change the appropriation actually to $1 million each year, so that overall instead of 1.5, it would be $2 million.
All right.
I have the audacity to sit here and do that, but I think I think these gentlemen will help establish the rationale for that. And Mr. Chief Bechtold will not be here today, so we just have my chief from Brooklyn Park and Sheriff Hennepin County. This money, it's pretty straightforward that they are creating or have created the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force. The level of crime, serious crime, has risen in the two communities I represent, Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center. I live in Brooklyn Park. And it has been an alarming rate, but equally or more alarming is the violent nature of the crime. And I think that robbery has gone up something in last year, went up 92%. And when one realizes that robbery is person-on-person crime, that's scary in and of itself. But I think that we're seeing even more violent assaults on people in the commission of that. And so we are determined that we're going to do something about this. And I want to say, just speaking for myself, and then I'll turn it over to these gentlemen, and that is that I don't think this is the only answer to crime in our suburban area or in our cities, in our state. I don't think it's the only answer to violent crime. I think there are other things. I'm sponsoring other kinds of legislation. For example, after-school kinds of programs for kids, and that's through the Education Finance Committee. We have to look, though, at stopping what's happening now, as well as look forward and have a more long-term vision for what we can do to prevent young people from making bad choices. But let me ask Sheriff Rich Stanek to speak first.
Thank you.
Welcome, Sheriff. Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Rich Stanek, Hennepin County Sheriff. It's a pleasure, Mr. Chair, members, to be here this afternoon with you. As Senator Scheid pointed out, I'm just going to briefly go over what is the proposed legislation and the request for funding. What we've done is formed a Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force, Mr. Chair and members, and there is a handout on a kind of a tannish vanilla sheet of paper. Do they have that? Yep. Okay. Great. This task force, Mr. Chair and members, is a multi-agency and a collaborative partnership with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, the United States Attorney's Office, a Minneapolis Police Department, the ATF, the FBI, Chief Setter from Brooklyn Park, Chief Bechtold from Brooklyn Center, and the other agencies across Hennepin County. Mr. Chair, members, as you know, and Senator Shai just pointed out, violent crime continues to increase across Hennepin County and our cities. If you look at the graph off to the right, just listing some of the cities, and I'm not sure if you can see that very well, but Chief Setter is going to go through a little more detail, but you can see a number of the cities that are listed there. Violent crime increases, part one crime, from 2001 to 2005, pretty significant jumps or increases. In fact, Mr. Chair, 45% of all violent crimes reported in Minnesota occur in Hennepin County. Now, I don't need to tell any of you that murder, robbery, shootings, I mean, they're on the front page of the local newspapers every day, and they usually lead the headlines on the 5, 6, 9, 10 o'clock news. If you look at up here in 2002, the violent crime in Hennepin County was 484 per 100,000 residents. In 2005, 3 years later, violent crime was 616 per 100,000 residents. It's not updated through 2006 because the FBI's Uniform Crime Report are not out, but those are the latest current numbers, and that's the trend that we're seeing across Hennepin County, and I'm sure that Chief Setter will tell you the same thing. Mr. Chair, members, we all know this as well, that crime is a regional problem. We've held meetings a number of times with the local suburban police chiefs, our other partners, our federal partners, our prosecutors, and, you know, we've all come to the same conclusion that we need to step up and do something regionally and across the board.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, we do have a quorum now.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if somebody would be willing to change the $750,000 in both places here to $1 million, I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, so moved.
Discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by aye.
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 Contrary, nay. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, if I may continue then. You know, criminals don't recognize the borders or jurisdictions, but know that the police must, and thus the need for this countywide effort. We've met, like I said, several times in the past weeks to study crime trends and the demographics with this increase in violent crime. This task force, the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force, really builds upon a very successful model that Minneapolis police put in place about 18 to 20 months ago. The Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee, which is a joint endeavor between the City of Minneapolis, Hennepin County, and its suburban counterparts, placed a formation and adequate funding at the top of its legislative priorities list because of the importance of curbing violent crime across the county. Mr. Chair, members, we're confident that the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force will be essential to curtail the rising crime that results from the lethal combination of guns, gangs, kids, and drugs. Having a former sheriff on your committee, you're at an advantage. He knows what it takes in order to stem the tide of rising crime, not just within cities and counties, but really statewide. It takes creative initiatives such as this, where you have joint partnerships and collaborations from all across the criminal justice system. I've said this before, Mr. Chair and members, that you know the three most important elements in fighting crime are prevention, intervention, and enforcement. And, you know, as cops or deputies, we're pretty good at the enforcement side. We're not so great at the prevention or intervention side. But we do look forward and look at long-term goals. Senator Scheid mentioned it earlier. This is just one piece of a multi-level strategy that we hope come out of this legislative session that will include prevention and intervention measures as well. The operation of the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force has begun. I would turn it over back to Senator Scheid and Chief Setter to add the perspective from some of our northern suburbs and what they're seeing and what they might find the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force.
Thanks, Sheriff Stanny. Chief Setter?
Yes, ma'am.
Go right ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I want to thank you for an opportunity to appear before the committee to discuss what I think is a very important initiative. Violent crime, as the sheriff said, has had a dramatic increase over the last 2 years. In Brooklyn Park, for example, between 1999 and 2004, our overall crime rate dropped almost 17%. That was pretty much a trend that we saw across the nation, some communities more than others. Starting in 2004, we started to see an increase, and in 2005, our crime rate rose 5%. 2006, it looks like the numbers are not finalized yet, but it'll be about 7%. That in and of itself is not as alarming as the next statistic I'll share with you. In 2006, we saw an overall 23% increase in violent crime. And the FBI defines violent crime as murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. All crimes against persons, probably the worst thing that could happen to any one of our citizens. Our robberies alone in 2006 increased 92%. We went from 83 robberies in 2005 to 158 in 2006. That's an incredible increase for us in a community of about 72,000 people. Our weapons violations were up 109%. I can tell you anecdotally, in working in the patrol division in the summer, we require all of our non-patrol police officers, including myself, to work at least four shifts on the weekends. I worked four shifts last summer, and on two occasions was involved in taking firearms off of people myself. And that's just, that's somebody my age shouldn't be doing that, to be quite frank with you. With that being said, we are seeing an increase, and we have convened meetings with many of the police chiefs in Hennepin County, many of the city managers and mayors. As recently as 2 weeks ago, Brooklyn Park hosted a meeting with the North Suburban city managers, mayors, and police chiefs. I've been in law enforcement for 30 years. It's the first time I've ever seen that broad of a collaborative sit down to discuss this issue on a local level. And that in and of itself, I think, reinforces to me how serious it is. I want to applaud Sheriff Stanek and Chief Dolan from the Minneapolis Police Department, who could not be here today, in their effort and their leadership. What we're trying to do here is replicate a model that I think we've used very successfully in this state through our drug task forces and through the gang strike force. Collaboration, interagency cooperation, having this agency all in one local area, so they're co-located in one building, having them under a unified command allows us to target the worst offenders. This is based on a model. I know that Sheriff Stanek, as a former captain in Minneapolis, was involved in development 2 years ago. And one of the things that convinced me that we needed to be a part of this because of our significant increase in violent crime is the success that they had. In less than 2 years, they had over 250 felony arrests, 92 federal indictments. I think that's an unprecedented success, and that was with the fraction of the resources we're trying to commit to this at this time at the county level. With that, I can tell you that Brooklyn Park is already committing two full-time officers to this, one immediately and one within 6 months. I'll be going back to our city council and asking for an appropriation to amend our police department's budget in this year just to add the officers for it. That is how high of a priority it is for our community. We have a lot of bad people in the communities, and I can tell you that this is a regional issue. It's not just Brooklyn Park or Brooklyn Center. It's something that we know is throughout the county, and I think this is a very successful model for us to replicate.
Thank you, Chief. Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair.
Do you have anybody else to testify?
No, we do not.
Okay. Questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, are you aware that we amended the $750 to be a total of $2 million, a million each?
Okay.
They believe that's what they will need.
I have a question. Senator Scheid, will this be done under, a joint powers agreement? Do people... Let me back up and see if I can make some sense out of what I'm trying to ask here. When we heard the presentation from the Financial Crimes Task Force, we heard that they were... Yeah, I got that. Yep. We heard that they continued to be supervised by their folks back in their own departments. They were the ones who signed the overtime requests and all those kinds of things. Do you envision that same sort of thing happening here? Because it would be from so many different areas?
Madam Chair, I'm going to let Sheriff respond to how this will actually work.
Sheriff Stanek.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, thank you very much for that question. It's true, Madam Chair, that this task force will operate under a joint powers agreement between the contributing members, such as Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, the Sheriff's Office, Minneapolis. We will, though, focus our efforts across Hennepin County, and if it takes us outside of Hennepin County, so be it. But we will operate under a joint powers agreement, both operationally as well as in terms of the setup of what we need to do, the legal side of it in terms of liability and coverage. In fact, we've already that joint powers agreement, I think it's in its final draft form and on its way back out to the local chiefs for approval.
And then Sheriff Stanek, do each of the city councils or the governing bodies all sign off on that as well?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, the county board would have to on behalf of the sheriff's office, and in addition, the Hennepin County would be the fiscal agent for this if the committee saw fit to allocate the funds. I think probably the same is true for the city of Brooklyn Park and other cities, Chief.
Madam Chair, members, this would be very similar to what we do currently with the Metro Gang Strike Force and the Drug Task Force. We'd each sign the Joint Powers Agreement. It would identify the issues such as supervisory control, costs, liability is the biggest thing for us in making sure that we have appropriate liability coverage when we're acting as one unit. And each public agency would have to have council approval is how it's worked for us in the past.
And then, Sheriff, on the other issue about, being supervised by Hennepin County or continuing to be supervised by their existing line of command?
Madam Chair, members, in terms of supervision, what we would envision would be, first off, there would be a governing board set up by the Joint Powers Agreement, so the contributing agencies would have equal say in terms of policy, operational procedures, things like that that are set up in the very beginning and then governed as the task force moves forward. The day-to-day operations, if an officer from Brooklyn Park is assigned to the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force, the day-to-day activities of that officer would be supervised by the commanders or what very well could be co-commanders of the task force itself.
Okay. And then, and I'm sorry, I came in the middle of the presentation. Did you cover, are the various other local units of government contributing funds as well as people?
Madam Chair, members, at this point we have not. We've begun discussions with the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners. I'm not sure what conversations the chiefs have had with their local agencies. What we've asked is for a $2 million appropriation over the biennium, understanding that I think the legislature would like to see some type of pilot project to curtail violent crime, not just in Hennepin County, but getting across the rest of the state. In future years, we're not asking that this be part of the sustained base budget, but rather if this task force is successful, like we say it will be, and I'm confident that it will be, based on our experiences in Minneapolis Pacific, that this task force could very well be funded off the seizures and asset forfeitures from the bad guys themselves that these folks go after, arrest, and put into jail or prison or whatever suits their needs.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, this is just for the committee to consider. On things like this, when we do we need to statutorily create this task force, or by fiat of giving money to the Commissioner of Public Safety to flow through to this task force, we've in essence created the task force.
Mr. Backus, do we need to create it, or can Hennepin County create it and we just help pay for it?
Right.
The brain trust.
Well, Madam Chair, then let me. I'm not being hostile to Senator Scheid and what she's trying to accomplish. I'm just thinking from an accountability perspective. If we're going to be given a couple million to a project, and with other ones, we ask them to kind of report back to us, let us know what's happening and what's going on with that. Is that something that we just haven't thought about with respect to this, or what?
Let's get counsel from our counsel.
Madam Chair, members, I think it would be up to the division and the chair in terms of how you'd like to structure it. I mean, I think, you could certainly require reporting from the task force or Hennepin County about what objectives they have achieved and things like that. If you'd like to, you could create the entire task force in statute. It would give you a way to shape, who's on it and things like that. Or, again, you could defer to Hennepin County essentially to oversee it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'd suggest, I think that you are really in the process of creating the task force as we speak and in the last few weeks. I mean, they intend to go forward with this. Chief Setter talked about dedicating two officers from the Brooklyn Park Department to this, and the City Council's agreed apparently to one.
Haven't had the discussion.
Okay, but I hope that they'll be able to do that. I don't see that. I'm not sure you want to get into creating a task force. I think they know what they need, and I trust these two gentlemen and Chief Bechtold and Chief Dolan to and his experience actually with the working with the county apparently just recently through the Joint Powers Agreement to let them, you know, do what they know needs to be done.
Madam Chair, members, if I may, just real quick.
Sheriff Stanton.
You know, you asked a good question, Senator, about, I guess, control or oversight of the task force. But this isn't unlike, we have five other task forces that operate in Hennepin County narcotics task forces. And we operate them through a joint powers agreement cooperatively between groups or regions of cities or communities, assign officers, personnel, whatever it may be, to go after that particular crime, in this case, narcotics. We do likewise with other task forces that we set up internally within the county, and I believe or assume other counties do as well. But that's the purpose of the joint powers agreement in the operational side, is for local autonomy, for us to get together, figure out how we're going to do this operationally, and bring it back in terms of the joint powers agreement to our governing bodies, which may be a city council or a county board of commissioners. We're happy, though, you asked another question about reporting structure, reporting requirements. You know, we'd fully expect to come back before this body to tell you our efforts, what we've done, what successes we've had, maybe where we haven't been so successful and where we might be able to do better, as well as ask for advice and guidance from this committee. That's part of our job and comes with it.
Okay. Any other questions? We'll put this aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and we can talk about whether you know, we want to require a report and those kinds of things as part of that. Senator Foley, you want to move the bill?
I would, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Foley moves that Senate File 1177 be recommended to pass and to be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. God, I hate that motion. All right. Any discussion on that motion? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Members, we're going. We have somebody who needs to leave fairly quickly, so we're going to go to Senate File 1500, number 4 on your agenda, so that we can accommodate a schedule.
Excuse me.
Sorry. I'm
going to
loosen
one.
Vote to chair the meeting. Senator Lance.
All right.
You're in. I guess I'm up.
Oh, goodness.
You need a laptop for this bill?
No.
No. For this bill.
On the file.
Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, this is Senate File 1500. I'm pleased to let you know that a group of accomplished nonprofit providers have organized a practical strategy for using SCARES tax dollars more efficiently and make community-based programs more effective for the issue of reentry. And we've had several bills before us this session talking about various reentry programs. This is a five-year demonstration project, and it relies on maximizing the performance of existing services in the private sector rather than creating an entirely new program or more bureaucracy. During a time when we as a community are having a difficult time in dealing with at-risk adults who cycle in and out of jail and in and out of prison, this demonstration offers a creative and refreshing way to address these challenges. Quite simply, this five-year demonstration is designed to provide much better outcomes at a cost taxpayers can afford and support. I have with me today, who's going to start, Mr. Thomas or
yes,
Mr. Mr. Steve Thomas is going to tell you more.
Mr. Thomas.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. I'm Steve Thomas, and I'm the CEO of a new social enterprise called The Network, which is the type of demonstration program that will benefit from Senate File 1500. And I'm joined this afternoon by Lewis King, president of Summit Academy OIC, and Dan Kane, president of RS Eden, two of our founding board members. Over a year ago, a team of Minnesota's leading healthcare, housing, workforce, and human service practitioners came together to address a common objective. achieve much better results in serving a group of at-risk adults, adults with history of incarceration, chronic unemployment, and often homelessness. A disproportionate number of these adults are African-American men, and they're likely to be poor, unemployed, socially isolated, and battling mental health conditions and substance abuse. Most of these men are also costly and routine users of public-funded services. Our partners, which includes the African American Men Project, the Family Housing Fund, Medica, North Point Health and Wellness Center, RS Eden, Summit Academy, OIC, and Twin Cities Rise, operate well-designed, well-managed, and well-intentioned programs. But a litany of social, financial, and bureaucratic hurdles undermine their potential impact. To complicate matters, the systems and services meant to assist these adults are fragmented, uncoordinated, and very expensive. The result is a costly duplication of effort, repeat interventions with poor outcomes, a narrow focus on symptoms rather than root causes, and there's a heavy reliance on institutional and short-term support. In response to these issues, our partners have crafted a shared vision and a practical strategy. That vision is that we intend to promote the recovery, resiliency, and prosperity of at-risk adults by creating communities of adults who are doing well. And just as important, our endeavor is driven by the belief that these adults have the potential to become somebody again, and that these adults have inherent value and potential. They're not bad people, but they did make some bad decisions and poor choices. By setting high expectations and providing access to the resources one needs to meet these expectations, at-risk adults, including ex-offenders who enroll in the network, will be offered the opportunity to become contributing and respectful members of society. These are lofty aspirations, but I assure you our vision is firmly grounded in real-life experience, and we're building our innovation around a set of proven practices and models from around the country. Essentially, the network consists of five core components: a cohesive package of safe, affordable housing, short-term employment, behavioral health care, access to health care, and community and family re-engagement. We're preparing to enroll our first 50 men this month, and this legislation, Senate File 1500, will enable an innovative project like ours to be launched as a five-year demonstration effort in 2006. The network's unique and compelling value and the demonstration proposed in this legislation is based on the following distinctions. As I said earlier, our approach and this demonstration is informed by research and builds on proven strategies and best practices. Our performance-based earned income strategy will hold us and the adults we serve accountable for results. An investment in this enterprise is a highly cost-effective alternative to the proven inefficiencies and limited effectiveness of the current approach. Our enterprise adds value to current programs by assembling providers into multidisciplinary service teams. And with these service teams, we can achieve scale and have greater impact than any one program or provider. One last point related to this before I turn it over to Mr. King is that we've attracted over $600,000 in private funding already, which is enabling us to begin testing and refining this product with the 50 men I referred to earlier. So let me, for a moment, turn it over to Mr. King.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear today. I'm Lewis King, president of Summit Academy OIC. We're a vocational training institute located in North Minneapolis, and we believe that the best social service program in the world is a job. We joined the network because of the cases that we saw of men coming to us who were ready to assume their responsibility as leaders in their families and working citizens. Many of them were either leaving the criminal justice system or, in some cases, were still in the workhouse while they were attending our training. We concentrate on the construction trades because it tends to be an arena that is friendly to people who might have a criminal background. In addition, the demographers show that there will be demand for workers in the future, and these are high-paying jobs that the gentleman can get. In partnership with Dunwoody, we train people for plumbing, electrical work, carpentry, and painting. We found, though, that they had some issues that we could not deal with. Some of them did not have adequate housing, and we're a school, and because of this instability, they could not attend us on a regular basis since they were bouncing around. The network would offer us a place where they could stay in clean, stable housing and at the same time come to school. In addition, when they leave the workhouse in some instances, or some of them just can't afford to come to school full-time with no visible signs of income, the network would offer short-term employment through their teams that go out and do contract work, and this too would allow the individuals to work and meet any requirements that they have upon leaving incarceration, or simply to earn a living while they're still in school. Many people like myself had to work their way through school, didn't have the luxury of someone else paying for it and not working. We view this as a good investment, and we think that it will add the stability for our graduates as we prepare them to become workers that will support this community and keep our businesses strong. Thank you.
Thank you. So in conclusion, once again, thank you for the opportunity to briefly describe this enterprise. Thank you, Senator Higgins. And we encourage you to endorse Senate File 1500. This legislation and the funding it provides will fundamentally be a smarter, more cost-effective way to deal with the prisoner reentry and challenge by improving the performance of existing programs and dramatically increasing the likelihood of ex-offenders becoming a positive and productive force in our community. Thank you.
Mr. Thomas, and thank you, Mr. King. Mr. King, did you want to add anything?
No, they told me I'm here just to answer questions.
Some of us heard you in the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee today already. So, Senator Moore?
I'll give you a chance to answer questions. Senator Higgins and maybe any of the witnesses, this is a five-year pilot. We're asking for, if my math is correct, in the summary sheet, 3.5 for the biennium. Is it part of the thinking that we would continue to fund this for all? We're kind of making a commitment for the tails up to the 5 years.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, I'm not sure how we do that. I think it would be wise for us to put that in the tails. We also could come back and say at the beginning of the next biennium, let's see how they're doing, a progress report. If it's not working, then we can reassess for the next round of funding.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, for the time being, though, in
this
essence,
biennium.
If we do this, we commit to this biennium and we're kind of committed for the five-year pilot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, I don't have a tails budget yet, so I don't know whether we can put the tails in a budget or not.
Okay.
I don't have it yet.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Moore.
Just to follow up, what is the total estimated cost or budget for the entire 5 years? Or if you want to break it down in terms of annually, what is the expected cost? And how much of what we're asking state funding is part of that cost?
The total five-year projection at the moment is about $15 million, okay? And to get back to the biennial question, as described in the bill, we'll be operating under a fixed rate pay-for-performance contract if this were to go through. The demonstration would be managed by corrections. So at the end of this biennium, we would have to prove that the results indicated in this bill are being achieved, and continued funding would be sought thereafter. But the total projection at the moment is about $15 million to serve over 500 men over the five-year demonstration.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I could ask the question in different ways. So this would be a 100% contract with you from the Department of Corrections. There wouldn't be any other resources coming from anywhere else for the demonstration project.
No, Mr. Chair, Senator, no, that's not right. The bulk of the funding would be through a contract with corrections. But, for instance, the evaluation would need to have private funding to supplement the state funding. There are other operating costs that would be supplemented with private funding. In fact, as I mentioned already, the founding board members have committed over $300,000 to this initiative already. We've attracted $450,000 from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So we would expect that rate of private investment to continue not just in this biennium, but over the five-year period.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Council, do we have a right to obligate a future legislative body to fill in beyond this current biennium? It seems to me that we don't have that authority.
Mr. Chair and Senator Foley, I think I just came in. I think I missed a lot of the lead into this conversation.
There was some talk about this being a five-year pilot project and tails or connection with it.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Turner.
I mean, generally we cannot obligate future legislatures, but is the funding sufficient for the five-year pilot project here?
Mr. Chairman, members, no, not according to the witnesses. What we can do is, appropriate the close to $4 million in this bill, 3.6 for the treatment, and is a quarter of a million for the evaluation, and say that we can say that this money is available until expended, so it would be spent, be carried over into the next biennium. We have also legislated that this will be included in the base budget. But we can't. They can do whatever they want. The next legislature, I mean, they can cut it out of the base budget. We can't appropriate for the next legislature, but we can give the Department of Finance instructions that it's our intention that it be included in the base budget.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if there are no other questions, I move that Senate File 1500 be recommended pass and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. I will now take up Senate File 1125. Senator Nelson.
800,000.
Okay. 25. It's 4 million.
All set, Senator Latz?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 1125, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a bill to provide grants for child care advocacy centers. These are the organizations that when there are allegations of sexual abuse of children, they intervene on referral from a whole variety of sources, law enforcement agencies and other social service agencies, to conduct the interviews of the alleged victims, the children, to prepare for possible court cases, to provide support services for those victims and their families, to assist them in getting through the trauma of the whole ordeal, and to guide the families, hopefully, to a better place. Sexual abuse of children is such a significant national problem that a recent study in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine stated 16% of males and 25% of females reported being sexually abused as a child. It's 1 in 4 women were sexually abused as a child. The total cost, direct, such as hospitalization, and indirect, such as the adult criminality aspect of it, are estimated at $94 billion. And the Minnesota Department of Human Services in 2005 estimated that 8,000 children were abused or neglected. I presume that's just in the state of Minnesota. However, The three centers that currently exist in Minnesota that are accredited have evaluated or interviewed approximately 2,000 children each year. And that means that about 6,000 children of those identified who become part of the institutional process have not received the kind of support, interviews, and other services that would be most helpful from trained professionals to the law enforcement system, as well as to give them the kind of support that they need to get on with their lives. Legislative funding has historically been appropriated for some of the activities of these evaluation centers. Some of the money has come through the Department of Human Services for specific purposes, for example, a 24-hour professional consultation line, some funding for forensic interviewer training. And there are also some specialized interviews and medical evaluation services that are provided by the three existing centers. But there isn't any longer-term broad-based legislative funding in place. And as a result, each center has had unstable financial futures. The revenues for the services do not cover their actual costs, unique costs of providing the best practices in interview and assessment services and the multidisciplinary approach to the investigation of child abuse. And losses in these areas drain from other services and results in deteriorating facilities. New resources will allow the centers to develop procedures to expand the pool of children for whom interviews are possible. And frankly, it's better to have it done by people who are better trained. New research from the University of New Hampshire shows that traditional investigations of child abuse, that is, without involvement of a child advocacy center, cost 36% more than investigations in which a child advocacy center was involved. So if you get the best practices, the best professionals involved early on and have it done right the first time, it saves money in the long run, as well as, of course, dealing more effectively with the situation. So this legislation would propose to fund the three existing accredited full member programs of the Minnesota chapter of the National Children's Alliance, as well as provide funding for three new centers which are currently associate member centers. They're seeking accreditation, and this is throughout Minnesota. Minneapolis, Duluth, St. Paul have accredited members, and Bemidji, Winona, and Rochester associate members. I'm going to ask witnesses here to elaborate on this, and the first person, I've got an order here. I don't know if you guys have talked among yourselves. Dr. Levitt, are you going to speak first? Yeah. Dr. Carolyn Levitt from the Midwest Children's Resource Center, please. Dr. Levitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And thank you for that very thorough introduction to the bill and what Children's Advocacy Centers are. Basically, Children's Advocacy Centers really are a team model for responding to the needs of abused children and really focus on the child as the major focus to protect that child from multiple interviews, from being taken from one department and to another and maybe becoming the victim through the whole process of the investigation. And what Children's Advocacy Centers are focusing on totally then is the coordination of the community response and putting the child in perspective in a safe, warm, comfortable environment at the Children's Advocacy Center. And these can be in a hospital medical building. It can be in a community center within a community agency, or it can be in a small little house that looks just like a home. So there's all kinds of different Children's Advocacy Center models. We have representing us today members of the various Children's Advocacy Centers that were listed, and I'd like maybe to introduce them first before I go on and talk. First, we have Patty Miller from First Witness. She's the executive director of First Witness, and she's invited one of her clients from their center, First Witness, Kayla, to speak to you today, and she'll be the second speaker. Also, we have Tom Frost from Corner House here in Minneapolis, and we also have John Locks, the Bloomington police chief to speak because he was at one time the board president of Corner House. And then we also have Tom Harbinson in the back and Victor Beath here from Maddie's Place in Winona, and they are here for answering questions if need be. There's also another advocacy center in Bemidji that I am very proud of being able to help establish to serve the tribal countries in northern Minnesota and the rural Bemidji area there as well. So in addition to the one that is mentioned also in Rochester that is an associate member that is just starting up kind of a member. But I'd like to explain a little bit more about what children's advocacy centers are. We're part of a national membership organization, really, that has helped us set standards so that actually people who do this kind of work are held accountable. They're held accountable through accreditation. To be an accredited member of a Children's Advocacy Center at the national level, you really have to have the multidisciplinary team in place. You have to do the quality type interviews that abused children require. You have to be able to have a physician or a nurse provider be able to examine the child, but they have to have some training. They have to know what they're doing. They have to know what the findings mean. You have to have somebody doing what's called the forensic interview, or in our case, the medical interview, that is then to take the details from the child and ask the child questions in a way that the answers are meaningful so that the questions are not included in the answer. And if you think about that, that's not the way you talk to children. When I talk to children as a doctor, I will ask them, that hurts down there, doesn't it? Or that must be pretty painful, isn't it, if it's really hurt that bad? That's the opposite way of what you want to talk to children who have been abused. So you want to be able to make sure that the child provides you all the information. And this is a tremendous concern for those people who are not trained to do it and don't do it very well. Through Children's Advocacy Centers, through their accreditation process, that quality of service gets judged by their site visit. The comfort for the child as they're brought there gets judged through that site visit. And so this national organization of, there actually are 400 accredited members nationally. There are about another 300 members who are associate members, but this is a national movement that has really addressed the needs of abused children and really in a very, very high-quality way, and we want to be able to sustain that in our state to add more and to really be able to continue the work that we it's just too expensive to do. It's something we can't. Our hospital contributes money because we're always at least $150,000 in the red at the bottom at the end of the year, and we really have to be able to sort of say we have to be able to sustain this for the children of our community. I think with that, maybe we'll go on. Oh, I'm sorry, go back to you.
Are there any questions of the committee from Dr. Levitt? Okay, who is your next witness?
Mr. Chair, I think we'll ask Chief Locks to speak. It's a pleasure for me in particular to appear with Chief Locks. When I was a Minnesota Assistant Attorney General, I was the lawyer for the Minnesota DARE Advisory Council that Chief Locks was a member of. And so, pleasure to work with him again, and welcome.
Thank you, Senator.
Chief Locks.
Members, my name is John Locks. I'm the current Chief of Police in Bloomington, and I'm wearing several hats today. And I mention them because with each of these hats comes an endorsement for the particular organization. I'm, of course, the Chief in Bloomington, a practitioner. I use the services. I'm the current President of Hennepin Chiefs. All of our agencies, most of our agencies in Hennepin County, contract with Corner House in our case because it's located in Hennepin County. We use the services, we depend on them. I'm also a board member of Minnesota Chiefs of Police, and we have an endorsement from the board on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs that want these centers to continue to exist and thrive
because of the great service that they offer.
Also, the Minnesota Sheriffs have signed on endorsing our efforts to gain more funding, as well as the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the Sexual Abuse Prevention Network, which is a national group of people.
That's a long list,
but I think it's important for you to know that a lot of people, not just those of us sitting at the table, want this to continue to thrive and grow. The valuable information as a practitioner that is gained is important for you to know. We are not particularly trying
through this process
to prove the innocence or the guilt of a particular person we're interviewing. We are simply trying to uncover the truth. And I think the strength of the program is that in about 20% of the cases, we show that sexual abuse did not take place, at least in the way that they are claiming. So I think it adds a lot of credibility to how we do business
show that an independent agency brings the facts forward for us, and then we act with that information. For those of you who have been around, and as I look down the table, I recognize many of the faces from years past. We remember the Scott County interviews and what problems that brought forward a few decades ago. And this was put in place. This process was put in place to make sure that that did not happen again. Another point I want to make is that local governments recognize that this is not just the state legislature's responsibility. We in Hennepin County supply $223,000 worth of funding of just the local police agencies to support this effort. So we are trying to step up and help offset the cost of running this type of operation. ECAC, Child Advocacy Center of Minnesota, has adapted. We are not a cookie-cutter model. In Hennepin County, we have full-time trained interviewers. Because of the volume, we can support a full-time staff doing that. In First Witness, they don't have the volume, which makes it more difficult to have a full-time trained staff. So they train police officers to do this work to be able to handle their caseload appropriately. So we're not trying to needlessly waste money and have staff sitting around waiting for cases to come in the door. So we adapt to what the local jurisdiction and the local needs are to make sure that we're serving everybody the best possible way. Let me just summarize. I had other comments, but they've been mentioned, so I won't go over them again. It's a valuable, essential resource. It proves or disproves the allegations. It eliminates multiple interviews, and there is local agency contribution to help offset the cost for this. Thank you, and I'd be glad to stand for questions.
Any questions from the committee? Actually, I'd like to ask a couple. I see that the three that are accredited are all big cities, St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Duluth. The three that are not accredited are in greater Minnesota. How long before those other centers become accredited? Does anyone know that?
I might comment on that, member. I have been involved with one in Bemidji, and they have seen, in this past year, they saw 100 children. They are the closest to be able to be accredited, but that does take about a two-year process to make that happen. So I think they're getting ready to begin that process. They're certainly associate members, and they've got a lot of the things in place, but they do need it. It'll probably take about another year.
So do the other three, they're just starting now, and they've got the whole 2 years to go yet?
Answer part of that question also. I know the CAC collaboration in Minnesota has been working with Rochester for quite some time through the hospital, and that one also is moving towards completion. They would not be starting at the very beginning. They've been working on this process. They've had a change in leadership, which slowed them down a little bit, but they're back on track and moving towards completion also.
What if there is a case of child sex abuse in Rice or Steele County, somewhere out in greater Minnesota, where there isn't an accredited center right now? I assume that the three that are accredited accept cases from anywhere in the state, and if so, how do you charge back for that?
Mr. Chair, I'll answer on behalf of Corner House. The executive director is here, but from my experience, there is a set fee for non-contractual services, so a per-interview fee. Corner House does routinely accept interviews from outside our normal service area, so outside the metro area. Anybody is welcome, and we will provide that service for a set fee.
Do you know what that fee is versus what you pay as a member? Does anybody know that?
About $900 per interview.
And what does it cost Bloomington since you're a member of
I am paying just under $13,000 a year for the number of interviews, and I do roughly a couple dozen, maybe more.
Okay. So for your membership, you can send as many there as you have.
That is correct.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Senator Latz, do you have – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we also have a young woman here who would like to share her story with you. This is Kayla. Is it Bjortomt? She'd like to tell you about her experience with First Witness.
Okay. Kayla, what was your last name, please?
Bjortant.
Bjortant?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Just go ahead.
Oh, okay. My name is Kayla, and I would like to thank all of you for this opportunity and for giving this bill a chance to help many kids in Minnesota. In 2001, I confided in my grandmother that I was being sexually abused. Being young, I didn't know what was going to happen. All I knew was that the abuse was going to stop, and at that time, that's all that mattered. I was told that the police were going to be picking me up from school, and then I was going to be taken to a place where I had to tell what had happened to me. I was very scared, and I started to feel like what I did was wrong because my family started to split, and there was a lot of crying. And being young, you know, you see crying, you think you've done something wrong. And then with the police picking me up from school, didn't really help much. So I started to think maybe I shouldn't have said anything at all, and maybe I should just take it back and just tell them, you know, I lied or whatever. And I didn't know where I was going. I was with the police officer. I figured I was going to be taken to a police station. And I wasn't. We pulled into this parking lot of a place that looked like a house, like somebody lived there. And so I started to feel a little bit better. And we rang a doorbell. Somebody came to the door and let us in. And when you walk in, it was like an office. And there was, it looked like a living room. And there was toys for kids. And it was a very homey feeling when you went in there. And it wasn't as scary as I thought it was going to be. And then when I started talking to the officer, it was hard to talk about what had happened, and there was a lot of things going through my head, but he made it more easy for me to talk about it. He drew pictures and asked questions that were easier to answer. And I think that working with somebody who knew what they were doing and what they were talking about helped a lot, instead of just having an officer who really didn't know anything about it to do the interview. And after we had, after I had done the interview and after I had talked to the officer, I didn't just get left to fend for myself. We went back to the center many times for follow-up counseling and different things like that. They helped a lot. Lisa is one of the ladies who worked there, and she helped with any problems that I had and setting up future counseling problems, different therapists, and things like that. I do believe that going to a center is better than going to a police station where you already are afraid of the things that you've done, and going to a police station where, you know, people think, well, that's where criminals go. That's a place where people who have done something wrong go. So I guess the centers are needed. They're a needed thing, and they do need the funding. And if I would have had to, go to a police station instead of a center, I probably would have taken it back, and I wouldn't be in front of you here today telling my story, and I wouldn't be the person who I am today. And I guess that's. I had the chance to be taken in by them instead of some of the kids who are just taken to a police station and put back on the streets. It helps a lot. And also, kids who go there, they grow up and they are adults. And if you don't take care of us as young children, we grow up into, you know, the problems that you're having today with what other people have been talking about, robbery and criminals. What I'm trying to say is we do grow up, and you want to help us out when we're young. And these centers do help. They do help you out a lot. And I'm just glad that I can be here today, and I really hope you take this into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Kayla. Any questions from committee members? Kayla, let me just ask you, how long did you work with the center after that initial interview?
Five to 6 months.
5 or 6, okay. Did they work just with you or with other members of your family as well?
No, they talked to my mom and my sister.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Okay, Senator Mott.
So, Kayla, you're here today. Are you glad that you told somebody?
Yes.
That's very good. Thank you. And thanks for being willing to share your very personal story with us.
You're welcome.
Senator Rosen?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, what's the age for these centers? They go up to 18? Age 18?
I will defer to some of the witnesses here. Yes, up to age 18.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, other questions? Senator Latz? Do you have other witnesses?
No other witnesses.
Okay.
I'd offer a motion that the bill be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Actually, before we take that, let me just ask one more fiscal question. I guess that's what we're asking about. But this is $2 million for three centers. What percentage of their total budget would that be for those three centers?
Actually,
is that in here somewhere?
$2 million is intended to leave to cover all six centers. Is that?
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Well, the bill says that it can only go to accredited members. So there's only three of them.
Actively pursuing that status, Mr. Chairman, lines 1.20.
I see. Okay. So $2 million for six centers. What percentage of their budgets would that be? Do you have a rough idea?
Maybe 20%, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Okay, on Senator Latz's motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you very much. Senator Latz, you're just going to stay there and take your next bill?
Chairman.
Senator Latz, Senate File 1150.
Mr. Chairman, this is a bill that would propose to provide outreach grants to deal with housing homeless people, or dealing with homeless people. And it's an important bill because a lot of times what happens is people who are homeless end up having direct contact with law enforcement agencies. And that's not always the best place for them to be dealt with. We shouldn't be housing homeless people with serious illnesses in our jails. Our police have more important tasks to handle than to deal with what are often petty offenses of the people who are living on the streets. Too often they spend their time dealing with individuals who repeatedly engage in minor but offensive behaviors. In response to this situation, the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs currently oversees three pilot projects located in Hennepin, Ramsey, and St. Louis counties. The projects are 1 year into their two-year grant. The total grant funding equals $390,000, with individual programs providing an additional $207,000 in matching contributions. Now, the purposes of these grants is to reduce the use of public safety and correctional resources in response to the community of homeless persons, to connect homeless people with housing and services, and to develop collaborative relationships with local police. Additional services include access to benefits, medical care, mental illness and chemical dependency treatment, and case management. Now, so far, these pilot projects have demonstrated significant success. Collectively, the projects have served 251 homeless individuals. Of the 216 actively receiving services, 48% have obtained stable housing. Preliminary data collected from the BCA indicates a decrease in arrest for program participants. Initial feedback from the programs indicate cooperative relationships with police departments and municipal groups. Project staff and police have identified the homeless persons at highest risk and have developed cooperative and innovative interventions. Given the success of the pilot projects at this stage, we propose to continue the current one-time funding and allow for expansion of the program to Greater Minnesota by requesting a total of $2 million for the coming biennium. Now I would like to introduce to you Kathy Tenbrook, who is the City-County Coordinator for Ending Homelessness in Minneapolis and Hennepin County, to provide some information for you.
Ms. Tenbrook, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. As Senator Latt said, my name is Kathy Tenbrook, the coordinator to end homelessness for the City of Minneapolis and Hennepin County. As many of you know, a couple of months ago, the City of Minneapolis and Hennepin County Board approved a 10-year plan to end homelessness in our community. The plan lays out six big goals, and the primary three being prevention, housing, and outreach. We see outreach as absolutely critical to engaging some of the longest-term homeless individuals in our community and getting them connected to services and housing. We know that this kind of engagement prevents unnecessary interaction with the criminal justice system, improves the quality of life for all citizens, and saves the public money. The support that the state has shown is helping us leverage additional dollars from local government and the private sector. With these new resources, we will expand on state support and develop over time a 24/7 system of coordinated outreach, building on what we learned from the pilot and providing an even more aggressive targeting of outreach and engagement to police-recommended areas and times of day, as well as targeting efforts to the highest users of our jail and shelter system. In Hennepin County, we've been gathering data on the highest users of both jail and shelter. So we've developed a list that includes people who have been in jail four or more times in the past 5 years and in shelter four or more times in the past 5 years. This list equals 266 people that have met both of these criteria. Of these 266 people, all homeless and intensively involved in the correction system, they have used a total of 66,000 stays of jail and shelter over 5 years. The top 60 people alone have used 33,000 stays. We know that targeting our efforts here, we can have a dramatic influence on the community. Reports from the provider in Hennepin County, who received the state's public safety grant, show that they have housed 52 of the 109 clients that they're working with on the street. This almost 50% housing success rate is up dramatically from the year before, prior to the grant, when only 15% had received housing. We are doing a better job of coordinating all of the resources in our community so that we can have the greatest impact. Housing, no doubt, significantly decreases the amount of arrests and detox admits, and outreach is the first critical step. We have seen, once again, thanks to state support, the value of new partnerships with the police departments and other city and county departments, as well as community and neighborhood groups. In Minneapolis, we now have procedures in place so that the first precinct police know exactly who to call to get assistance with somebody on the streets. They also have given our outreach workers a list of their top concerns of people that they are consistently working with on the street so the outreach workers can target them specifically. And reports from the first precinct are very good. They love the new procedure. It saves them time, and it provides social service rather than criminal justice response. Outreach workers are also working with public defenders, and their involvement, they report, has resulted in some cases of individuals moving into housing instead of serving a jail sentence. We now have other departments like the bridge maintenance crew at the City of Minneapolis who now call outreach workers directly to assist them in working with people sleeping under bridges. These new procedures go a long way in getting people the services and housing they need and avoiding unnecessary interaction with the criminal justice system. So I thank you again for the opportunity to speak today, and thank you for considering this bill. And I look forward to our continued partnership with the state on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tenbrook. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Tenbrook, what was the criminal activity is that they were arrested. What's the main criminal activity? Was it theft? Is it drugs?
Prior to, you mean that the police were, mm-hmm. were concerned about people? Livability issues, public urination, loitering, lurking, maybe aggressive panhandling, solicitation, those kinds of things.
I see. Yeah. Thank you.
Let me follow up on that, if I may. You said 266 people, and how many stays in jail? 3,000?
66,000 stays.
66,000 stays?
In jail and shelter.
Oh, and shelters. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because we're trying to do the crossover between who's homeless and also consistently in our jails. And that was the 266 people met both those criteria.
That means this is in 1 year?
In 5 years.
Oh, in 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to say that would average 240 days a year. So divide that by, so it's about 50 days a year on average.
Yeah, and it's what's so interesting is really the top, like I said, the top 60 used half of those stays. So it's really the smaller amount of people who end up using a greater number of
stays.
So
could you describe a little, just, you know, not lengthy, but just describe what do you do with these folks when you see them in, they're presumably in jail, and you start working with them?
Well,
just walk us through what you do with them.
Yeah, that's the plan. I mean, since this grant has been in place, we've been able to target a little bit more that way. But what we'd like to do with additional state dollars, hopefully, and local dollars, private dollars, is expand it to a 24/7 system so we have enough outreach workers so that we can target folks even when they're in jail and do, in a sense, do in-reach as well as outreach so that when people are in jail, before they come back on the street and it just returns the cycle, we can get to them sooner and work with them and see if we can get them connected to housing and resources before they're back on the street doing the same thing.
So your program doesn't provide, you facilitate getting people to other services.
Right. The outreach workers that currently do this in Hennepin County connect them to other resources.
And what do you estimate would be the cost for you to provide service to one person?
I don't know the answer to that. Do you know? These folks do it in St. Paul, so they would have a... I'm not the Hennepin County outreach provider, so I don't know that, but I could get
just
that
for you. Just take the 266 that... that's how many you've worked on in the pilot program over 5 years?
No, this is two separate things. The number that this outreach team has worked on in this first year of the two-year pilot was 109 individuals that they had in Hennepin County. And of those, they housed 52 of them, so nearly 50%. The 266 that I'm mentioning is how we'd like to expand our work in Hennepin County and target even more our highest users. So that's something that hasn't happened yet, but it's something we'd like to do with additional dollars.
So how much did it – what was the budget for the 109 that you did serve?
Here.
Just approximately. Are you talking half a million or 200,000?
Well, the amount of money that Hennepin County, 189,000 was what they got from the pilot, the state's pilot.
So that's about
– And that's for 2 years.
2 years. So that's about 1,800 per person you worked with, about 900 a year.
Right.
And is that typical that you would work with somebody for that over what period of time? 2 years would be typical? I see somebody nodding yes.
Yeah, it depends on the person. I think some people that the outreach workers connect with and get into housing, where they get them into housing, those providers take over to provide services and that kind of assistance. With some folks, however, the outreach workers do keep their relationship for quite a long time because it's the relationship that those folks trust the most.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. When you say housing, this money pays for that housing then?
No, the outreach money in the pilot that the state provides the outreach assistance. But what we're doing is we're trying to work throughout the whole system so that the outreach workers are very much connected with housing providers and that the police department and everybody's working together so that the housing resources that we do have in the community, for example, some of the money that has come from the state in the form of support service dollars has been incredibly helpful at getting some of those folks that the outreach workers are working with into permanent housing. So this money for this pilot doesn't provide actually the housing costs, but we then leverage it to work with other housing providers to get those folks in. But outreach is often the first step. Without the outreach, it's really difficult for us to connect with the longest-term homeless folks to even get them to the housing provider.
So for outreach, you're employing individuals to go out and provide the outreach and
exactly.
make the contact and get the homeless folks into the other services.
And those individual outreach workers, like Brett, I mean, he's really the one who could probably best answer these questions, like Brett, know all of the resources in the community and connect people to the right place depending on their circumstances.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe probably just Allison and myself were at this table. We're on the homeless shelter tour last Monday night, and it was fascinating. And I cried like a baby after the tour to the youth center. So does this do anything? Are you just working with certain populations? Are you going into the outreach to the youth? Is there, Senator Latz, do you know if there's anything specific for youth in this portion of the bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I don't believe there's anything that targets youth specifically in this bill. Certainly they would be covered if they were homeless. They might need some different services than the adults would need. They'd be included in the umbrella.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Letts, that would be, that basically is my question, that the services would apply to them also for the outreach and okay.
Yes.
Can I answer that?
Hello. My name is Brett Byfield. And I work with the St. Paul Police Homeless Outreach Project, work for South Metro Human Services. And we have not to date targeted youth services. We work very collaboratively with youth. As a matter of fact, we have a meeting tomorrow with or Thursday with workers, with youth workers and St. Paul Police to further collaborate our efforts. We work hard to help youth not come to Dorothy Day Center or come to adult services so that they become acculturated to those services. So we have not specifically targeted youth, but what we're learning could easily be tailored to youth, and we can, and we're actually doing a lot of educational seminars in community to help these relationships work. To date, we've not targeted youth specifically.
Ms. Tenbrook?
Just to continue that, to answer your question, in Minneapolis, we do have a collaborative called StreetWorks that mm-hmm. is specifically focused, in St. Paul too, specifically focused on youth outreach because they're very specific workers who really have a lot of expertise working with youth and those runaway, prostituted youth, those kinds of experiences. This has been, I think, primarily geared towards some of the long-term homeless.
Recidivists
who've been sort of cycling through the systems. We hope that our youth don't ever get to the place where they would need to be served by this particular pilot, but that we do have youth-specific outreach that we also do in Minneapolis and Hennepin County.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Letts,
Mr. Byfield also has some remarks he'd like to share, and then we have a St. Paul police inspector can share his experience as well, if you want.
Mr. Byfield?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I am Brett Byfield. I work for South Metro Human Services. We were the entity granted the St. Paul portion of this program and have been working this program, so I'm grateful to be here today. What we've been able to do over the last 21 months is to establish and work on very solid relationships which help the system work better together to target folks who are chronically downtown and doing quality of life crimes, often possession charges in addition to the other kinds of charges that Kathy mentioned. We work very collaboratively with the court system. We have an attorney specifically targeted to working with our folks, and we so that as people get a tag and a collar, we work with the courts, we work with the judges to work on alternative sentencing pieces to just straight incarceration, encouraging treatment, encouraging housing, encouraging other pieces which will help folks do better. We've gotten a number of folks on disability because they haven't been properly assessed, tremendous traumatic brain injuries on the streets that have not been assessed properly. And by giving attention to folks who are typically not conforming and complying with other kinds of programs, we've been able to create a lot of positive outcomes. I had the honor also at the beginning of our grant period of going with two St. Paul police officers to visit a program in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, that has a 24/7 system of cops dedicated to working on issues of homelessness and the outreach workers that support those efforts. And we became inspired with what they had, and we came back and we started some housing in sober housing, and now we are in collaboration in helping to run three houses where they are sober houses, but you don't need to be 100% sober to be there. You can't use on site. And we have police officers that regularly visit, including one who's assigned to help support the housing. And what it has done, I've been an outreach worker for 20 years, and what's been inspiring to me over this last year and a half has been the collaboration and the way that the systems have wanted to work together. The courts are excited to talk to police officers about how you wrote the tag and how we can use it to leverage positive outcomes, and how our outreach workers know police officers very well and vice versa. We are colleagues. We are working with the same folk, and we now have common outcomes in mind. And what it has done, apart from creating really positive relationships between police and outreach workers, the courts, all the systems, probation officers, etc., but it has fundamentally changed in St. Paul the way homeless folks who are chronically in trouble look to police, look to outreach workers. We're talking the same story. We're giving them the same information, and we're rooting for them. And we're able to place them in our houses, and then some of the officers even come by and visit and say, are you still doing well over there? And it's kind of like relationship is what cures all of us. It helps us. And we have folks who are human asteroids. They've been kicked around for a long time. They don't have essential relationships. They don't have trust. They don't believe a more positive outcome is ever going to find them. So you just, when you don't have hope, screw it. You do whatever's going to make pain go away for you. And so by way of creating these relationships where they know police officers are rooting for you and we're in it together, it creates the potential for change, which has been really transformative. And we are excited about the potential to continue this opportunity. And I have to say, on behalf of St. Paul Police Department, they were co-award winners of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency Award to End Long-Term Homelessness. I don't think there's another police department in the country that has won an award to try end long-term homelessness. And this is a beginning piece. This was a little pilot. We had $82,000 here in St. Paul over 21 months. So, and we're trying to leverage some pieces through Laura Cadwell and are, I think, working towards creating some vouchers so that we can more successfully transition people through. But truly, we're just beginning. We would love the opportunity to continue to discover what are best practices for working with the folks who are the most chronically disenfranchised from any rational claim to hope, and can, by way of the relationships we're developing and the system's inclusion, and everybody's happy to play ball together. We've had all these parallel universes, and by working together, we really help people make better outcomes possible. And it has been a very positive experience, and I look forward. I'm honored that that the commander is here today to testify as well.
Commander Vomostek, you have some comments?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having me and members of the committee. I am the senior commander of what's called the Central District. There are three districts in the city of St. Paul. One is on the west part of town, the central part of town, and the east side. My district encompasses the north end, where you're located right now, downtown, West 7th Street, and the west side. I have the largest number of homeless people in the city, whether it be at Dorothy Day, Mary Hall, Listening House, Salvation Army, or the Union Gospel Mission. One thing I found when I came here to this position almost 3 years ago is that we live in an email world today. No one thinks anything of emailing the mayor about a problem, and he has no problem forwarding that to the chief, which then comes to my desk. And it's just a reality that we have today. People communicate a lot through email, and a lot of complaints that I was receiving in the downtown area revolved around homelessness. I've learned a lot over the last 2.5 years about homelessness. I didn't know until just maybe a year ago that 60% of the homeless are mentally ill, that there are more families that are becoming homeless, more children that are becoming homeless, that the homeless have the same fears of crime and being victims of crime that everybody else does, and that they deserved quality police service just like everybody else. I have 13 officers that work in the downtown area. I could use more, of course. I can't police the downtown area and provide the quality of service that I need to without partnerships. We approached the providers of homeless services maybe 2.5 years ago and said, we need your help. We have to work together. And there was some skepticism, I think, at first, but we all got on the same page, and we started to form relationships, and we started to work together. And I think it is one of the uniquest partnerships if anywhere in the country. And a typical example might be this, and this is a true story. I get an email from a person living in a wealthy new condominium development on Shepherd Road and Chestnut. And the person is complaining about a guy who's pushing a cart full of bread and things like some food, and he throws it down the riverbank, and he urinates in the parking lot, and he's creating problems. And I asked Brian Cook at that time if he would go and visit with him. Brian worked for People Incorporated. Never done anything like that before. Brian was surprised to get the call. He went down there, found the guy, got him to Regents Hospital where he needed to be, met with the complainant, left him his card, and it was a resolved situation that was a long-term solution, and I sent zero police cars down there to take care of that. I mean, I could send those or divert those cars to a choking baby or a robbery or something like that, and I could go on. I have numerous examples. And it's interesting to note that the officers, who were somewhat skeptical at first, when they came to me and said, we need to get our partners together because we have to talk about detox issues. We're getting killed on the weekends, and we need some solutions. And when they're on board, you know you've got something going. And it's really worked out very, very well. We didn't know a lot about mental health in the long term, and the partners that we have provided us education on mental health and trained our officers downtown. And I mean, it's been a tremendous supportive relationship. I could not police this downtown and provide the services for those people that live here. St. Paul is changing. St. Paul, more people are living downtown, and there are more homeless downtown. We were at a meeting the other day at Dorothy Day. They have now anywhere from 165 to 170 people sleeping on mats at night. And these are people that, as police officers, we're on the front line trying to serve them as well as everybody else. This partnership has been recognized nationally. I know Phil Mangiano from the Bush administration stopped to look at the houses that we're using on the west side. We didn't go into this for awards, but we did receive the long-term housing award from the state of Minnesota with our partners, and one of our officers is in Washington, D.C. right now to receive an award, a national award, for this pilot, for what started with your help a year ago has become a national model. And we didn't go into this to do that. We went into this to serve human beings, to serve people, wherever they were coming from, whether they lived in an expensive condominium downtown or they were living on the street That's what we got into it for. It's been a tremendous success. I would never picture us policing the downtown without our partners. I would never, ever even consider going back. And I really feel that we're going to continue to move forward, whether it be more housing, more collaborative efforts with the city and county attorney, with the judges, with mental health professionals who we need to get involved. And I really want to tell you how much we appreciate your help. This has really truly been, in my mind, a true blessing, and we just are going to keep going, and it's just been a great effort. There's more I could say about it, but I've talked enough. So,
thank you. Any questions from the committee? Senator Moore?
Well, Mr. Chair, and Senator Latz, but maybe somebody could share with me, maybe Mr. Turner, didn't we do something? The governor had a big initiative to end homelessness, and we did something really big. Did you all not get any of the benefits of the fruit of that package, or maybe you can help me understand that?
Yeah, the state's business plan to end long-term homeless, the resources that have come from that initiative have been exceedingly helpful to local communities on ending homelessness. In fact, the folks that were housed from this pilot in Hennepin County, the 52 people that were housed, most of them were housed because we had access to service dollars that the state had approved. You had approved $10 million in flexible service dollars, support services. And that fund provides housing subsidies and support services to people who are experiencing long-term homelessness. And that has been, without it, I've been doing this work for years, and those rental subsidies and support services have without a doubt been the best tool we've ever had for getting people off the street. So the plan, the long-term homeless plan at the state, in addition to this, has been just a wonderful tool for us.
Sometimes we don't understand the terms because they have definitions, but what's the definition of long-term homelessness? How long do you have to be homeless before you hit long-term homeless?
Well, in the state has defined it as 1 year homeless or four incidences in the last 3 years of homelessness.
Okay. Four incidences of any duration? And this isn't an area I know much about either, but homelessness doesn't necessarily mean you have to just be living in shelters, does it? Homeless just means you don't have a place of your own. So you could be living theoretically with an uncle and an aunt, or and you'd if it's just temporary, you're considered homeless. Is that correct?
In our minds, that's correct. There are different definitions. There's a federal definition and a state definition, and in my mind, as the coordinator to end homelessness in Minneapolis and Hennepin County, yes. If you don't have a permanent place to stay, safe and secure, if you're doubling, tripling up with, you know, friends, you are considered homeless.
If you're hiding from the landlord, it's not a good thing.
That's true. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen?
That seems to be very prevalent with the youth. Right. That's where you see that, where they're sleeping on somebody's couch for long periods of time. And
I was trying to... in greater Minnesota, it's a different kind of an issue because... and I think I've said this story before, but in Northfield, for example, we all know that Stardust and Eddie Budinsky and Dice, we know who the homeless people are in small towns. Mm-hmm. And they used to stop into my law office, and we'd give them a dollar to shovel our sidewalk. Yeah. I don't know what they did with the dollar after that, but we kind of took care of them. But then every once in a while, Eddie died under the bridge a few years back, and everybody in town knew him so well, we were terribly sad. But I don't know. I'm just wondering if in greater Minnesota, I think they find they're probably classified as homeless yet, but very few of them do live under bridges. We don't have shelters where they can go like Dorothy Day. So I was just trying to contrast. The different the homeless problem here in the Twin Cities is a lot different, but it still exists in greater Minnesota.
Yes, it does.
Based on the definition that you use, for sure.
I think, Mr. Chair, it's much more visible in the Twin Cities, yeah. But certainly in greater Minnesota, it's a
I think that's my point. Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Senator Foley?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Based on the observation, I spent all those years in Health and Human Services, and we looked at that issue of homelessness, that you could find a lot of people that are homeless in Edina or Eden Prairie or any of those communities. And I venture to say that there are a goodly number of people living in Northfield that neither you or I know who they are, but they're in that category.
That's probably true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Senator Latz, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1150 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, hearing no other discussion, all in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is Senator Higgins coming back for her bill? I guess there's just hers and mine.
Go for it.
I can do mine in about 2 minutes because it has no fiscal note.
Go for it.
Do you want to do mine? Senator Lath, or here, Senator Foley.
Senator Neville.
Okay. We can make it as fast as last time.
Unfortunately, she's the only one.
Mr. Chair, are you ready?
Senator Neville,
Senate
File 780.
780 is a very simple bill. It doubles the thresholds for theft and bad checks. So currently, anything up to $250 is a misdemeanor. That will go to $500. Anything from 500 to 1,000 would be a gross misdemeanor, and a felony would go from 500 to 1,000. That's basically the rate of inflation. And I think maybe Mr. Turner can assist me on this, but I did not think there would be a fiscal note on it, and I think that's the word we got back, is that there is no fiscal note. So I don't know if people want to ask any more questions in the policy committee. I've got some witnesses, if you have questions, that we can try to answer. One from the county attorneys, one from the public defenders.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Neville, when was the last time these thresholds were raised?
Well, for the felony, it goes back to the 1980s. 1987. I think there was a small change in the amount between misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor after that. Just a second here. I do have a summary of it. One of you guys know off the top? I might have the wrong file.
Senator, if I may answer your question, I'm Tom Plunkett. I'm from the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and 87 is the most recent substantive change. There was a change that actually dropped it down from 250 to 200 at one point. Some of these haven't been changed though since, I believe, the 60s. So there's several. Sorry?
Madam Chair, I was just saying we missed this a couple of years ago.
Actually, Senator Rosen, 1999, there was a change in misdemeanor. I'm sorry, gross misdemeanor. Going from 200 to 250. That's where it's at now. But for the felony, it's been 500 since 1987.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Rosa.
Excuse my ignorance, Senator Neville, but where do the funds go to? Or do they are appropriated?
All this does is is change the levels at which the crime is either a misdemeanor, gross, or felony. It doesn't affect where the fine money goes at all.
But for the most part, I think
fine money. Yeah, where does it go?
To be honest with you, I'm not sure. I think most of it comes to the state.
General fund?
But I think there's a formula. I think some of it may get... Is Mr. Turner still here? Sometimes he knows those off the top of his head. I don't have the answer for that.
Senator Lance?
Madam Chair, the the thresholds here define the level of the crime. The fine is up to the judge in sentencing when someone is convicted, and that fine gets distributed according to the same formula that any other fines for convictions get distributed. I think some of it goes to the court administrators, some goes to municipalities or counties, some of it comes to the state. It funds a whole variety of services in the criminal justice system.
The primary effect of this bill will be, I think, that city attorneys prosecute misdemeanors, and so they'll be getting a few more cases, and county attorneys will probably be getting a few less.
Senator Lance.
Madam Chair, one of the other effects of this bill would be that it will create fewer felons who, as a practical matter, don't deserve to be felons. How old these numbers are, if you're driving a car and you sideswipe another vehicle and you take off, you might be charged with felony criminal damage to property because you caused a $750 damage to the left front quarter panel of a vehicle. It doesn't take much to cost that much to repair a vehicle, but that's the value of the damage, and that's what determines the threshold or the level of offense that's charged. So some of the systems deal with that as diversions. Sometimes they get negotiated down to other levels of offense, but they enter the system as felonies. And, depending on what happens with the expungement proposals and other things that are out there, once you're charged with a felony, it's in the public record that that's what you were charged with, even if you end up being convicted of a lesser offense. So it really does have a long-term impact.
And, Chair, I agree with what Senator Latz just said. Two years ago, last year, when I had a bill, the Second Chance bill, we did get a felony, we got a fiscal note on this provision, and there's the possibility that 17 fewer offenders would go to prison. So, there's a little savings. So there should be no positive bed impact. There should be a savings of 17 beds, more or less.
Like that.
To corrections.
Move to
it. We can't move it to the floor from here, can we? Or can we?
No, we can leave it here and put it in our bill, though.
It has no fiscal impact.
Sure it does. It saves us money.
Well, you want to put it in for saving money?
Yeah.
Oh,
that's $1.3 million.
It's $1 million. Oh, is that what you came up with?
The preliminary, isn't that?
Oh, I didn't see the one from this year.
I think
yet.
It's in your packet.
I didn't get
here.
It either.
Let's send one down to you.
I only had the one from last year.
Right.
Look at it. Is it still 17?
It's more guys.
That's
We project to save in fiscal year 08, 27 to 43 beds. 09 is 40 to 65, and 2010 is 54 to 87.
Oh, that's better than last year.
Last page.
Better than last year.
That's better than last year. We like that.
If we're going to create beds, then maybe this will offset that cost a little bit.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So,
thank you.
Would you like to move to lay it over for possible inclusion?
I so move.
Any other discussion on this bill? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Adopted. Thank you for bringing us some money.
Can I spend it?
Madam Chair, thank me. I send it to you. It was up to him. He would go to the floor.
Yeah. In my absence, have all the other bills except mine been heard?
Okay. We spent all the money that you just saved, Madam Chair.
And that's
all. Yeah. Word from that one.
Sarah, we have a handout. Join us.
Won't be any checks before long. Senator Higgins, Senate File 1488.
Mr. Chair, this is another re-entry proposal, and this one is specifically addressing domestic violence and intimate partner violence. We have two folks here to tell us all about this bill, Dr. Oliver Williams from the Institute of Domestic Violence at the U, and Marcus Polk, from also from the Institute on Domestic Violence at the U. I don't know who wants to go first. Go right ahead.
It's an honor to be here today to have the opportunity to speak with you about our effort. We were asked... my name is Dr. Oliver J. Williams. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota School of Social Work, and I'm also the executive director of the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community. What you have in front of you is a DVD that we created called Safe Return Initiative, and that gives you more information. I know you're all so busy, but in your leisure time, you may want to take a look at this 22-minute video. Two of the people who were featured in that are from the Twin Cities, people who have been incarcerated and on parole, and women in relationships with men who have been in prison and on parole, and also people who are from Portland. We were asked by the Office of Justice Programs, U.S. Department of Justice, and the Office on Violence Against Women to take a look at the issues of the intersection of domestic violence and reentry. So we've had an opportunity to sort of look at this issue from around the country and seen an opportunity to be able to address something and do something unique in Minnesota compared to what occurs in the rest of the country. What we want to do is to try to create a seamless model from the prison to the community to address the issue of domestic violence. Why is it important to think about this? Well, one of the issues is that that issues related to violence occur much in higher rates among high-risk populations. And people who have gone to prison and live and return to high-stress and violent communities are at higher risk for having domestic violence episodes. The other issue is that in reentry efforts, there's attention given to substance abuse, to employment, to housing, to skills and development of skills, but there's no attention to the issue of domestic violence. When we've looked at the issues from different places when parole programs end up developing plans and family plans to see where this man can return home to. One of the things that's interesting is they develop plans to help him succeed in other areas of his life, except how to more effectively integrate back into families and communities. So what we've looked at is the fact that there's another reality, too, that there's no attention given to how you support and how you can be concerned about the issues of battered women. One of the things that we've noticed as well is that there's a high number of people who end up being revoked and returned back to prison because of domestic violence within the households. As a matter of fact, one of the programs that we looked at in another state ended up developing a domestic violence program within their prison system because they had such high numbers of men that returned back to prison because of domestic violence. So what we want to do is to try to find some way to be able to help people more effectively integrate back into the families, into communities which they, in fact, return to. Oftentimes people think that, if you lock somebody up, you've got some issue of safety and some security, but the vast majority of the people that go to prison return without very much attention to how we can find ways to be responsive to them. So, and to the issues that they bring. Now, why is this important also? One of the things that I am aware of is that in battered women's programs and also in battered intervention programs, the issues that men who have histories of violence or high potential for violence, they don't talk about a lot of the things that come up in with men and women when men come back home from prison. some of the issues and discussions that come up, we have found, are not addressed in battered women's programs or in batters programs. When we did a study a while back that was a national study where we ended up looking at and asking men in prison on parole and women in relationships with men in prison on parole, what were the issues that ended up resulting in violence in the family? Now, one of the things that's interesting to me is I've done work in domestic violence for 30 years. And some of the issues that we have explored are clearly the right issues. So it's not a matter of suggesting that we dump what already exists to create something different. It's enriching what we already do. And having batterers intervention programs and social service programs and reentry programs and battered women's programs put these issues on the radar screen and give some attention to it. I think the consequence will be is that we may have fewer people who recidivate and get revoked and sent back to prison. But what's most important to me is the fact that we create safer families and safer households. Now, one issue I'd like to say, and then if you have questions and you know, entertain those, is that sometimes when people have been distanced from their families and distanced from communities, when they come back and try to integrate, there are issues that they have to get resolved. Sometimes how they defined what it means to be a contributing family member and what it means to be a man. Those issues have to be resolved. Sometimes I think that it's important for us to figure out what a number of people in corrections have told us is that good programming is good security. But the other thing is the fact that when you need to start to think about reentry should not be just when the person comes out. You should start thinking about it when they're in prison. So we want to work in prisons. We want to be able to work in communities. We want to coordinate groups of people who may not relate to each other quite in the same way as we're suggesting and to develop a collaboration in ways that may be a little bit different than what presently occurs. But I think that we've got a number of people who are excited. We've been talking and interacting with people in the certainly in Minnesota, having conversations with them about this. And I think there's some interest in terms of doing this. So,
thank you, Dr. Williams. Mr. Pope, would you like to make your remarks before going to questions, or is you available to answer questions?
I'm available for questions. Yes.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the members of the committee? I don't see any. So, Senator Higgins, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1488 be recommended to pass and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you. There will be no further business to come before the committee. We are adjourned.